So this call is a special treat for me. I first met Neil about 3.5, 4 years ago when he had volunteered to help us build a website for this organization called Inspire. And when I first met him, I was, sitting on the couch talking to him, and the vibe that struck me the most within the first 5 minutes of just, talking to him is sensing this unshakable commitment at his depth, and this unusual feeling, an unusual capacity for humility, and also just a tremendous capacity for deep listening. And so it's really good to be in a position where we get to turn the tables a little bit on Neil and listen to him. I had an introduction that I wanted to go through quickly about him, but Neil actually sent me this manifesto for his life that he wrote back in his early 20s, and just reading that, I was so touched that I thought it would be the perfect way to actually introduce him. So this is something Neil actually wrote to a girlfriend in his early 20s when he just had already at that point had some clarity about what his life wanted was going to be like. So this is Neil. He said, "When I was a young kid, I had dreams of making it rich. I thought having a big, luxurious house and a fancy car were the things that made me successful in life. Since then, I have realized a few things. First, that one's career is just a single aspect of one's life, so achieving financial success is not the same as overall success. In fact, many rich people suffer from the known mo' money, mo' problems phenomenon, where wealth becomes a burden in other spheres of their life. Second, I realized that a big house and a big car are not sustainable, i.e., the world could not accommodate everyone having these things. But most importantly, I realized that if I had these things, I would be a very elite minority in a world to have this privilege, at the very tip of a broad pyramid. The last point has, in one shape or another, struck in my mind for much of my adult years. As I've gotten less ignorant, I've come to question whether this is an ideal existence. Sure, I'm rich and comfortable, but what about the other half of the world who survives on less than $2 a day? More generally, I was concerned that I would be working for my own comforts and leaving behind the multitudes. What's the good of that? Early on in my life, I came to realize that if something makes me happy, but those around me are not, then I am not as happy. Everyone should be entitled to happiness, the same happiness that I've enjoyed in my life. To me, this is the essential motivation for social work. I want to come up, but I don't want to come up alone, and certainly not at the expense of pushing others down. I want my success to be tied to the common man, even the poor man. If I'm to live in a big house, so be it. But if I have that level of wealth, well, I damn well better have lifted up hundreds or even thousands of others in the process, commensurately. I think that this is similar to the idea of CEOs trying to tie their raises and bonuses to the pay increase given to a company's average worker. I like that idea. But there's something more. To me, it's not sufficient to lift up just anyone. I commend entrepreneurs who generate livelihoods through their ingenuity and foresight and creativity. I aspire to be such a person. But my workforce has to be the poorest, or as close to the poorest as possible. I will strive to work for the poorest man until I finally reach out to him. I suspect that this will keep me occupied enough to never actually achieve the big house dream. If I've reached it, I'll know I probably haven't reached down deep enough. I feel that this is the life worth living, and though it's scary, I have very little doubt that the alternative, i.e., turn my back and work for my own big house and fancy car, will never suffice. I will not judge others on this choice because I understand that decision since it was what I had in my own mind for most of my life. But I'm resolved to not resort to it and pray to God that I have the strength to carry beyond." Wow. So that's Neil. I mean, very quickly, he's been like a service-based volunteer since his teens, a Manasadhana volunteer for the last few years since he started going to India, founder of Asvay, which is a tech award winner, and also a soccer star. So Neil, you've had this strong influence of generosity and kindness and service since your childhood. Can you tell us a little bit more about where that came from, who some of the influencers were that created that spirit in you?
Sure, I can talk about that. First, thanks for the introduction, and thanks for embarrassing me about how I write love letters to my girlfriend. Not exactly the most romantic thing to write, but, you know, I had to get it off my chest. I think for me, definitely my journey in service started young because I was around people who, you know, imbibe values of generosity, compassion, and kindness. And so I saw that growing up. Two people in particular are family members. So the first person who really was my first teacher in generosity was my mom. I still think my mom is probably the most generous person that I know. She's just incredibly giving. Anybody in my family would tell you the same thing. She's a member of our family, is like really the glue. She keeps everybody together. She's the one who calls everybody regularly and checks up on people and just really goes the extra mile for people. And so for me and my brother, I think it was a huge privilege to be around somebody like that. And she was, I mean, really set an example for the depths you can go and the lengths you can go for your family. And that certainly made a big impression on me growing up. And then the second person who really influenced me, and he probably wouldn't even know that he was a big influence on me, was my cousin, Ashish. Ashish was 4 years older than me, and my brother and I and Ashish and my other cousin, Amy, his sister, grew up together. And Ashish, growing up, was like a really big idol. He was really my idol. And everything he did, I try to mimic. And, you know, he was a normal kid, but he actually has a lot. He's a very, very big-hearted person himself, very generous. And even, you know, when you're a kid, it's rare to see generosity being practiced. But Ashish was definitely somebody who would always make sure that all the other kids, you know, got to eat, got to get whatever they needed before himself. And then later on, I don't know if he's on this call, but if he is, I'm going to embarrass him with this story. Later on in college, Ashish was a college student. He was a teenager, basically, but he was doing he was trading stocks. He had gotten into trading stocks, and he had turned a small bank account into a whole lot of money. He really became quite rich as a teenager and a college student. And so he was this guy in college. He was in Berkeley, and he had all this money, like unbelievable amount of money, almost more than you could even spend. And but what did he do? He actually ended up spending his money on all of his friends. And there's amazing stories about how he would take them out to different places and they would do things together. But he'd always make sure that if he was doing something, he would do it together. And that's really his spirit. And just being around him also was a big influence for me. So I would say those two people were definitely role models for me.
That's awesome. So you started actually volunteering with Service Space as a teenager. How did those influences with your mom and your cousin lead you to connect with the ecosystem?
Yeah, so it just so happened that my cousin Ashish was friends with Viral. They were college roommates. And so I got connected to Viral, and then through Viral got connected to the rest of the Service Space then Charity Focus group. And I actually first really got inspired by, after reading the SF Weekly article that Nipun had an interview in. And I can't find this email. I've been looking for it for some time, but I wrote him this really long email telling him how inspired I was and how I wanted to join the Tigers team. And, I was just super pumped up and, you know, went to, one of the early days, the meetings were at Sun Microsystems when Nipun worked there. And I remember going there and really feeling the energy. And I think the thing that stood out even at a young age, I didn't quite understand it that back then because I hadn't really served, but selfless service. And this is a theme that came up later in my life, but there is a real distinction between service for, you know, selfish purposes and really selfless service. And it struck me that this group of people was really committed to selfless service, which I felt was more pure. And that was something I resonated with. So I, you know, carried forward from there.
How do you define that distinction between selfless service and selfish service?
I wouldn't define it so much as I've had experiences of both. The most vivid of those was 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit. I got really inspired. I just really felt moved after that happened, that disaster happened, that I wanted to serve in some way. I just really felt conviction that I wanted to do that. So I volunteered with the Red Cross, and I got stationed in Biloxi, Mississippi. And this was really my first like huge kind of like move, you know, travel somewhere to serve. It was a big step for me. And so I was stationed in Biloxi, Mississippi in this air base, and there was hundreds of volunteers there, Red Cross volunteers. Everybody came to serve, but I also noticed that people were there kind of almost like they were there on a service vacation. So they were there to serve, but then they were also, they wanted to make sure that they got all the food and they got the best sandwich and, you know, they got three sandwiches and complaining about this and that. And I just felt like the spirit of being there to serve other people was kind of lost in the midst of people kind of there because they wanted to kind of put a badge, you know, a badge of honor on their sleeve that says, I served in Katrina. It's almost like a lot of people were kind of hopping from disaster to disaster, talking about how they had this experience and that experience. And it just struck me as something of losing the spirit of why they were there. And that trip and interacting with different volunteers who would come to serve in this capacity, but from different agendas and different backgrounds, to me was a real eye-opener in terms of what it really means to serve in a selfless way. And so from that experience, I was really committed to exploring service in the most way possible. When you talk about humility, and that's to me a very important aspect of service, and serving humbly and serving in a way that dissolves the ego, I think to me is a better way to grow through service.
So along with service, it seems like technology has played a really long-standing role in your life. Can you tell us a little bit more about why you chose to go into computer science and then grad school and what all of that has taught you about your purpose and also service and everything else that it reflects upon?
Yeah. So I think technology and computers in particular, I got into it kind of, I backed into it. I didn't really have an inclination. When I was growing up, I really didn't have much experience with computers. I wasn't really indoors a whole lot when I was growing up. I was playing sports. That was my thing, and I was always outside. And then college, high school came, it was finishing up, and it's time to go to college. And then I thought I was going to go to college and study economics, again, because my cousin Ashish was studying economics, and so I went into college thinking.
Neil, I think you cut out for a second there.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I think it's better.
So I came into college thinking I was going to study something different, but I took the very first introduction to computer science class in college, and I really just fell in love. I knew after that first class that this is what I wanted to do. I really got excited about programming, computer programs. And so while I didn't have any experience with computers before college, I didn't even have my own email address, but I really felt attracted to computer science from being exposed in college and kind of grew from there. And so that passion was always there, and it continued to grow in college. And after college, I wanted to continue to stay in technology, and I wanted to work and write software and so on. So I did that. I started, I got a job in Silicon Valley, and I was writing code and so on. But around the same time, I was also reading other stuff. I was reading philosophy and getting more into spirituality and really hard questions of myself. And you know, mostly around what my life path was and where I was going and why I was here and what I should be doing. And also through that process, I kind of started experimenting in service in various ways. And I went to Katrina and all of that. And through all of those experiences, I basically concluded that working and going in the path that I was at was going to, I was going to be able to do work that I liked, but ultimately it wasn't going to completely fulfill me. I was still lacking that aspect of service through technology or through whatever kind of career path I was having. I wanted it to not just be about enriching myself and this, you know, the small society slice of the world around me, but, you know, try to make it a more inclusive kind of work and try to reach the unreached and, you know, not contribute to, you know, a digital divide that I was kind of witness to. So I wanted to do something more. And around the same time, a bunch of researchers in academia were exploring this new area of research at the time called information communication technology for development. So trying to apply IT for international development problems. And amongst them was a young researcher named Thupan Parikh, who at the time was a grad student. He's now a professor at Berkeley. I really got inspired by his work and really wanted to do what he was doing. And so that's why I decided to apply to grad school and pursue research.
Hmm. So you and Thupan obviously are the co-founders of Alazde. Usually when I try and introduce Alazde, I talk about it from the space of Alaj Otlo, which you guys initially started out with. And I kind of describe it as like peer-to-peer farmer education through cell phones, voice-activated cell phones. I know that's a rather clumsy way of describing it, but and I know also know that Alaj Otlo has grown into Alaj Day, which is a much bigger platform that goes beyond just peer-to-peer education for farmers. So can you tell us a little bit more about Alaj Day and what the journey has been to come to that?
Yeah, when I got to grad school, I generally knew that I wanted to do something using technology in, you know, development. And I really didn't know what technology, I really didn't know what kind of development. The first thing I did was I just went to India and just hung out and kind of just observed. And in that process, I came into contact with a bunch of organizations and then also, you know, local people and spent some time living in villages and understanding people's problems and just trying to observe as much as I can and learn as much as I could. And through that work, I got into touch with a lot of farmers and in particular and agricultural communities and tried to really get to know farmers and what their challenges were, in particular from, you know, information access lens, because I was still a technologist, so I was trying to figure out how I could be of service. And in that process, a couple insights came out. One was that there was a gap in terms of access to relevant, locally relevant information that was on demand, that was in local languages. So people didn't have access to the internet. Even if they did have access to the internet, you know, they may not speak English. So most of the content on the internet is English. So that's a barrier. They may not be comfortable using computers because they're, you know, they're not used to it. They may not be able to afford computers, and they may just be illiterate. A lot of people have low literacy or no literacy in rural areas. And so there was an access gap. So that was one insight. The other insight was that there was a lot of latent expertise in the communities themselves. So, you know, meeting hundreds of farmers, literally, I came to find out that these were really accomplished, experienced, savvy, innovative, creative people. And they just didn't have really a systematic way to share what they knew with each other. I mean, it was all kind of informal and ad hoc. But what if they had something like the internet where they could, you know, share information in an efficient way and learn from each other? And in that way, it's very practical and it's very relevant because it's somebody, you know, who shares your problems. But, you know, may have an insight that you don't. And so that's really beneficial as opposed to some kind of imported information. So with those insights, we came up with a simple, kind of idea, which was leverage the mobile phone, which was already in most people's hands, as a device for people to basically be able to access and share information. And we used voice as the medium to overcome some of those constraints that I mentioned, which, literacy, language, et cetera. And so basically, we set up a service for farmers to be able to access what was basically a voice message board. So people dialed a phone number, recorded their question in their own language, the system. Other people could browse it and potentially even respond. So in that way, sort of farmers were able to exchange information with each other. It's kind of like a public voice message board. And so we deployed that with a local organization in Ahmedabad in Gujarat, and it quickly took off and was quite popular. And so that was kind of our first experience, and that's Avaaz Ortlo, which you had mentioned. And then basically what happened was the design and usage of it was a focus of my thesis. And as I was working on this thesis, other organizations around India kind of took notice of what we were doing and said, hey, this is actually cool technology that we would also be able to use for our own communication purposes. Can we use it? And oh, by the way, these are not just agricultural organizations. These are organizations that work in health, human rights, labor, education, you name it. Basically, they just needed a way to reach disconnected people. And this is what we were doing. And so that's where we decided to start this company, Avaaz Day, which basically provides this technology as a hosted solution so that organizations anywhere in India can be able to take advantage of the same tool for their own purposes.
Yeah. So, but you particularly have been quite drawn to farming and agriculture. Why is that?
Yeah, I think there's something very special about farming because I think I've written about this before. Like, if I compare a farmer to me, like in terms of somebody, in terms of like a person, a professional. So for me, like it's very indirect how I earn, how I eat, how I earn money for my food. I type with using my fingers. I type keys on a keyboard, and they show up on a computer screen. And then something happens so that I get money for doing that. And then I can use money to buy food at the grocery store and eat it. And so it's like very weird. Like, how does this, there's this long chain of events that connects me typing random keys to me actually being able to feed myself. So there's this long chain. It just seems very inelegant. Whereas a farmer, he goes out to the field every day and is literally feeding himself with his own hands. He's working the field. He's working the soil. He's harvesting crops. And so that whole chain, the connection of work to feeding his belly, that it's a very short chain. And I found something very elegant about that. And I felt like that's there's something to that. And I think so that's what originally drew me in. And then also just kind of speaking and getting to know farmers in India in particular, but also in the U.S., I've gotten to know many farmers. It's a hard life. It's a very difficult thing. It's sometimes nowadays kind of glamorized. It's very hard work. But I think there's something ultimately satisfying where you can do physically taxing work, but there's also a creative and an intellectually challenging component to it. And it's a green job and it feeds yourself with good, clean, healthy food. It's really got it all. I really got attracted because of that.
So one of the big decisions about going into that, which I think would be hard work and a difficult challenge for most people, is making this decision that you made, which was getting a one-way ticket for India. I'm really interested in hearing about sort of how you processed that decision about getting the one-way ticket and what some of the challenges are around making that choice of sort of being a half a world away from so many friends and family, and just the challenges of being working in India using technology in a field like farming, which most people don't tend to think of as very highly technology based. So just kind of the challenges around that one-way ticket decision and all the challenges that come with that decision and what you're doing in India.
Yeah, I've been spending time in India, significant time in India for like the past 4 years. So the decision to come here on the one-way ticket was a long time coming. Like growing up, I would come to India and, you know, I'd come mostly as a visitor or for family visits or a wedding. So it was a very surface level kind of exposure. And through those exposures, I really didn't care for it much. I thought it was, I saw all the things that you see at the surface level. I saw the pollution, I saw the heat, the population, the discomforts. And so it wasn't until I started coming here for work, for my research, that I kind of had a chance to go beyond that and see what life is like here, you know, from an everyday perspective. And what I've discovered is that, and I think this probably goes for any place that you go and live, there's beauty in every place. And I find that there is incredible beauty about India and living here, that you just have to kind of spend time to get below the surface and experience. And, you know, people who've been on this call before and have heard stories about Jayashree, you get a sense of it. But even beyond that, just in any place you go, there is beautiful things about it. There's things that I get from living here in India that I absolutely do not get living in California, despite all the seeming comforts. There's just things that you don't get. And at the same time, I love living in California, and the things I love about there, many things I don't get here. So what I found is that there's things I love about both places, and I love both places. And now I just feel like there's two instead of one. And really, living in a second place and really making it your home makes you appreciate both places. You get to see what you love about both places. And when you go to either of those, you really appreciate that place, you know, all the much more. So I that's what kind of happened to me. The transition is basically that I stopped looking at this place as not California, but as Ahmedabad. And there's beauty about being in Ahmedabad, and I just had to appreciate it. So that's, you know, I think in terms of getting used to life here, that's the transition. In terms of the technology, I mean, maybe we can talk about that more. I'm trained as a computer scientist, and I have a degree in computer science. But to be honest, I'm actually skeptical about both computers and science. You know, so it's something that you often don't share with the people who are your colleagues, but it's really true for me. Like, and even if you look at the work that we do, it's very minimal technology. Like, we try to do the least amount possible to serve our means, to serve our ends, the most kind of lightweight intervention that you can do, but still, you know, kind of incorporate technology as appropriate. So for example, we're using this voice-based service. It's using mobile phones, which people already have. So we're not making them use something new. It's speaking, it's basically interacting with voice. So it's something you're already used to doing, especially here in India. It's an oral culture and people are just used to talking. And so it's a smaller leap than, for example, making people text or whatever. But yet it's quite powerful because it kind of opens up this new ability for people to really share in a new way and have more voices heard. And so that's really the design philosophy that I take and TAP takes in many of the things that we do. And then also, you know, the science aspect of it and science in general. I mean, as a scientist and being trained as a researcher and a scientist, the thing that it sticks out most to me is the limitations of science. And I'm always conscious of those things. I feel that there's always ways to get the result that you want in science. You know, you could always design an experiment to prove the point that you want to make. So you have to be very careful about how you use science. And I think you can use science to good effect, but it's a double-edged sword. And so, you know, there's limitations to that. I think what I try to do in my research and in my work in general is do stuff that people are interested in using and is of value to them. First, create the value. And then, you know, if there's good science that comes out of it, great. If you know, you can make a company out of it, great. But those are kind of just byproducts. The main thing is to create value.
So, you know, you're one of these guys who adds value in so many dimensions. I mean, with what you're doing with Avajde, it's obviously providing a huge platform, not only for farmers, but all other organizations that use this. And then, you know, you help out with Manasana Saturday Special. Anyone who reads your blog just knows that you've got your thumb in, like, so many fantastic, wonderful service pies. So I kind of wanted to hear your insights about how you integrate hard work also with relaxation. And you actually once shared this in the context of procrastination as well. So what's the way that you process the relationship between these things, hard work, relaxation, procrastination?
I think it was a Gandhi quote someone asked him, you know, you work 16 hours a day, 18 hours a day. It's, you know, during the independence movement, you know, all these things are happening. You're running, you know, this entire, you know, movement for an entire country. There's all these people and you're always constantly busy and all these things going on. Don't you ever take a vacation? Someone asked this to Gandhi. And Gandhi said, actually, I'm always on vacation. This is my vacation. He answered to that effect, meaning like he didn't look at it as work because he was doing what he was totally aligned with. And so he was, it was natural for him to put that amount of time and effort and concentration into it. I feel like I've been blessed to be able to align myself with the same kind of work. I mean, I do work that I am, legitimately passionate about. Everything that I do on a daily basis, and I do, you know, many things, but all of those things are things I love, and I really derive a lot of joy and satisfaction from those things. So I just feel like I've been able to maneuver myself to be in a situation where I can work 18 hours a day or whatever it is, but spend those 18 hours doing things that I feel are very worthwhile. So it doesn't end up seeming like so much work. I don't know if that answered your question.
It's close. It's good. But the question that comes out of that is, you know, a lot of people, I think, don't seem to feel like they're blessed with having that alignment between their work in a way that just allows them to concentrate and focus and not feel tired after 18 hours of work. So what would you say to them? I mean, what's the process towards getting closer to that level of alignment? What has been your process?
And before Neil responds, for those that want to engage in the Q&A, this is probably a good time to start getting in the queue. You can just hit *6. That way we're most efficient. So go for it. Sorry, Neil.
How much more time do we have before Q&A starts?
We probably want to start Q&A right after this or whenever you feel it appropriate. But it's a little past 10, so we're trying to end at 10:30, so probably is a good time to engage in Q&A.
Okay.
But go ahead, Neil. Rahul's question and your response.
Yeah. So I guess the question was around how do you get into the position where you're able to do work that aligns. I think there's no shortcut to that. I feel like my experience has been that the way you get to that point is you work really, really hard and you keep working until you find out what those things are that really make you come alive. And that means trying a lot of things and really taking risks and putting yourself out there and being honest with yourself and questioning yourself. But, you know, I think for me, I'm not the smartest person. I definitely don't have a lot of like God-given talent or skills in many things. But I do know that one thing that I have is a really strong work ethic. I feel like I can outwork anybody. And I feel that's my biggest strength. And so I feel like that's allowed me to be able to try to push the envelope towards things that, work that is meaningful. The other thing I'll say is along with doing work and working hard, you need to take time out and reflect and introspect and hold a space of silence for yourself so that you can let that work, you can let that work absorb and you can feel what that means to you and what directions you want to take it in next. And also I just feel like, having complementing like intensive work with taking time away to be in silence and to calm yourself and to be in stillness. That itself is also hard work, but it also ends up feeding into your active work, and makes it more worthwhile. So I would say that the kind of reinforcing process of working hard, trying things, putting yourself out there, being honest with yourself, and then taking time away to reflect and iterate and continue to kind of move towards it. It's an iterative process. I remember Birju and I were talking some time ago. Birju is another service-based volunteer, and he said something really interesting about how he was thinking about aligning his life towards work that was more towards gift economy. He was thinking about that, and he said that the way that you do it is in small steps. So you can't all of a sudden decide that you're going to live in a gift economy way. You have to start eliminating, particular requirements and needs so that you can live with less. And then so if you start living with less, then you need less. And so, it's more feasible for you to live on, others' kindness. I might not be able to live in a gift economy way tomorrow, but I could, do away with my gym membership tomorrow. Maybe that's one less thing. Maybe I just do push-ups at home. And then the next day, maybe I could start hand washing machine.
You're chopping out a little bit. So Neil, if you can still hear me, thanks so much for sharing all these insights. I still have, I came up with a list of questions, and I could keep going deeply into that, but I know that a lot of folks have probably queuing up, so wanted to open it up to others who have questions.
Hello, my name is Sarah Hobson, and I live in the Bay Area, and I work with a foundation called Newfield Foundation, and all of our work is supporting rural women's organizations and farmer organizations in West Africa. And Neil, a lot of what you were saying resonated a lot with my own work and touched me a lot. And actually in the 80s I spent a lot of time in Karnataka working with peasant farmer organizations. And can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. So my question is whether when you're next in the Bay Area, you'd be willing to get together probably with a number of, I work in collaboration with a number of foundations, NGOs. We collaborate a lot. We're really interested in finding useful, feasible technologies that the women themselves want and the farmer groups themselves want. We found that a lot of their priorities have been technologies that are to do with labor reduction, because so many of them spend hours and hours and hours working by hand, and we found that it's a very creative process if they can collectively own equipment that reduces a lot of their burden. It often then leads to very creative processes within the community. We've also found that many of them, and it's interesting being in the Bay Area, being sort of in the heart of Silicon Valley, but also in the heart of the biotech industry. And a lot of the farmers are increasingly being affected by the introduction of seeds that don't in any way take account of their own traditional seeds. So the whole technology around the modernization of agriculture and seeds is having a huge impact. And if and when you're next in the Bay Area, I'd love to be able to bring together a group of people to have dialogue with you, and to have a group where we could really tease out some of the issues, because I think you've already put your finger on the fact that many of what we consider innovative and liberating here in the West is not actually what's needed or the priority in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thanks, Sarah, for reaching out, and let's definitely get in touch, and maybe we'll talk more offline. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Caller ID says unknown, so I'm not sure who the mysterious person is, but you If you heard the call to be unmuted, you are on.
Okay, hi, this is Urmila. I'm Neil's mom. I'm going to make it short and sweet. I'm proud of my son. Very dedicated, loving, caring human being. Thank you.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, Auntie, thank you for being on the call and for giving the world a gift of Neil. He's a remarkable person that makes a lot of people smile, and it wouldn't happen without you.
Love you, Mom.
Neil, this is Ram. So I had a question on, you know, you made an interesting point in terms of the limitations of technology, the sense that this is only a part of the solution. So I wanted to ask you, in terms of culture and values and things like that, what's your own sense of the role that they play relative to technology?
I understand that Tapan has joined the call, and maybe we can put him on the spot and respond. Ram, would you mind repeating the question? And,
sure. Yeah.
And Tapan, I'm going to unmute you, and it'd be great if you could chime in with a response since you're
sure.
pretty close.
Just to quickly repeat the question. My work is in sustainability, and one of the things that comes up repeatedly is technology versus cultural values in a way, in terms of changing behavior. And so I wanted to just ask Neil, in terms of the work he's been doing, where does he see values and culture fitting in relative to technology in terms of their importance?
Tapan, how's that for a welcome to the call?
I was supposed to be a fly on the wall, as I understood. This is not fair, Nipun.
There you are.
I was waiting for 5 seconds. I wasn't even sure how you know I'm on the call. Do you have some kind of dashboard going on there? I don't know.
This is years of meditation.
you felt a ripple in the forest, I think.
Yeah, but how would you respond to that? We do have a longish queue, but while Neil gets back on, how would you respond to that question of values and technology, which is, of course, central to everything you're teaching and doing?
Yeah, I think there's, two answers to that question. I mean, one is that I think technology is a conduit for the transmission of values and culture. It's not a perfect conduit, you know, and nothing is a perfect conduit, but it's one conduit. And so the kind of work Neil and I have been doing, and mostly Neil with Awaz Day, is for us, you know, I think, or at least for me, I see it as an opportunity to bridge different kinds of cultures, you know, the culture of farmers to the culture of this call, to the culture of the diaspora, to the culture of the organization serving farmers. And so as a conduit of values and of culture, I think the kinds of technologies that we want to bring will help different groups understand themselves better, hopefully, and to be able to work together better. I think the second part of that question is that obviously when we design technology and we design services and organizations to support that technology, we bring our own values to that process. And so, you know, in the work that we've been doing with Awaz Day and a lot of our other projects, there's a lot of our own values that we bring to that work. And, you know, people like Somik have helped us externalize and understand that value system, and hopefully we represent it in Awaz Day, in the organization, and in the technology that we build.
Neil, if you're back on and you want to respond or add to it. If you're not back on, you are muted, sorry. Neil,
hello, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. So we were listening. I don't have much more to add other than, in my experience, I'll just say that every person literally has a different context that they're approaching technology. So groups, we've been working with rural communities in India. You have to totally rethink how a technology works and how people perceive it. There's, you know, there's intimidation, there's, you know, lack of experience. And so you really have to throw out the door in many ways your assumptions about how people perceive technology and kind of start from the needs up.
Awesome. Thank you. We'll go to the next caller. And this is just a reminder to keep the question short also so we can get through everybody. And also a reminder that if you want to get on the queue, star 6 is what you would need to press.
That's good. Thank you, Nipun. Thank you, Urmila Aunty, and I totally echo what Nipun said. Thank you for the gift of the beauty that you bring in. And we heard so many stories from Neil, and one particular was the how artistically and creatively you cut mangoes. I'm looking forward for that. Thank you, Aunty. And I also felt your tear of joy as you're swelling up there. Thank you. Thank you for that. It means a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, my question, I think, is going to be long, but I won't ask the entire question and to build a pretext to it. But the bottom line is, the other day I was, you know, as usual, generally have conversation with our farmers every Saturday. One family in particular, this farmer was opening his heart, as always, every week, and he was sharing something deep inside. And I wanted to ask Neil how he would process this. One thing he said was he does not want any of his children to follow him, and he wants his one son to be a computer science person, another one to be economic person, and another one to be a doctor, and so on. And one of the primary reason he quotes is not only the farming and the agriculture, just not the hard work, but the influence he sees in his life, with the future being really bleak because of all the, you know, genetic things and the dependency on the chemicals and so on. So I wanted to hear what Neil, you had to say on that. Thank you.
Maybe it will be Tapan. Neil is calling all the way from India, through Skype, and it looks like he's not on a good connection necessarily. Oh, he's back on, and I need to unmute him. Neil, any thoughts on what? I don't know how much of Prakash's question you got, but his question was, you know, his neighborhood farmers are saying that I don't want my son to be a farmer.
Yeah, and can you hear me okay, guys?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry about all the technical difficulties. That's actually the case here in India as well. I mean, the next generation of potential farmers are leaving the cities to try to get better jobs in the cities. And you can't really tell them, no, you shouldn't do that. We certainly wouldn't do that. They're going to make the decision that they think is best for themselves. And, you know, what I've seen actually in my experience in India is it's a trajectory. I mean, I think in the U.S. we've started to experience this where we've been so kind of on this sharp plane of consumerism, and now we're starting to realize the downsides of consumerism. Well, people in India are starting that journey, and they're just starting to experience consumerism. And I think, you know, they won't really recognize the downsides. I can't tell them the downsides. They're going to have to experience it themselves. You know, they may realize later on that, you know, as we are in the U.S., a simpler life has a lot of benefits. But it's really difficult and not really appropriate for somebody like me to tell them that. I mean, you have to kind of experience it yourself.
Yeah. We'll go to the next question, and if those that want to get on the queue, just hit star 6. We have Babu Patel on.
Yeah, hi, Neil. This is Babu Mama calling you, wishing you the very best of luck, and keep up the good work. I don't have any question. I'm just wishing him a luck.
That's great.
I think good. he's doing good job, and yeah. This is on behalf of our family. Okay.
And Neil's got a big fan club, so we're all part of it. Thank you, Babu.
I've been trailing all his blog all the time. I'm telling Neil that I've been reading all his blog while he's in India.
Thank you.
Is he still on?
He is on. Neil, you heard.
Yes,
Yes.
I'll just say that no matter the size of the fan club, Babu Mama is always has taken the number one spot in my fan club.
Didn't you have at one point, he says, you know, I you compared him to Amitabh Bachchan or something? That was great. Thank you. Lavanya, I think you're on next.
Hi, Nipun. Neil, this was a great call, and I think some of the questions that I wanted to ask have already been asked. But one follow-up question with, I guess I'm in the research field, so I keep trying to have this balance between doing research as well as doing something that's relevant. In the process, there is this tussle between doing something which is useful and practical in the field, plus something that's maybe cutting edge and trying to develop technology. And I guess both are required, but do you have any comments on that? And I'd like Tapan to chime in too.
Yeah, I think this is something that is a really good question for anybody who's in research. I struggled with this in my entire career as a PhD student, which was basically, how do I balance doing something that was practically relevant on the ground, but, you know, graduating, essentially, which required me to extract generalizable knowledge from this work. And there is no formula. I think for me, there was a couple parts of the equation that helped. One was I had very supportive advisors, Tapan was at Berkeley, and then I have a co-advisor at Stanford, Scott Klemmer, and both of them were very supportive of my work. And basically, they were both supportive of me doing something that was relevant, that people were using, and then using that as a backdrop to start asking research questions. And so we were able to take what we were doing and ask really deep in important questions around the provision of technology in underserved areas, and we were able to answer those questions. So I think that's, you know, that way worked for me. I think that's not necessarily the only way, and I don't think there is only one way. But certainly the model in this whole game is Louis Pasteur, who Scott Klemmer, my advisor, always reminded me of. Louis Pasteur invented pasteurization. At the time that he invented it, it was something that ended up saving millions of people's lives. At the same time, pasteurization was the end result of a long body of research that he endeavored into that was fundamental to the field of microbiology. So we did something that was of practical relevance, but of deep theoretical value as well. That's what, you know, we've tried to strive towards.
Tapan, did you have anything to add to that? Because I think it was also addressed to you.
I think one thing I learned is once a student graduates, you don't speak for him anymore. So I think Neil did great.
most awesome. We're at the tail end of our time together here, and I wanted to hand it over to Amit. But I wanted to ask Neil one last question to kind of bring it into the closure part. And that was, Neil, what have you learned about the wisdom of the farmers? You've worked a lot with farmers. You've gone out and done field research. You've tried to empower them. And you've told me many stories on different occasions around the wisdom of farmers. And I just wonder if you can just share an anecdote or so around that particular value of like learning from the bottom up, so to speak, and close with that. And after that, Amit can perhaps do our little closing circle of gratitude.
I would just say, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
What I've learned is that everybody has wisdom. Everybody has something to share. That's been kind of the key motivation for the work that I've been trying to do, is to amplify people's voices. Everybody has something to share. In each and every farmer has potentially a seed of wisdom that they can share. And yeah, in my experience, I've come across many farmers who are really, really remarkable, you know, inventors, and you know, in a different context, they would be very famous inventors or, you know, scientists or thinkers or just creative people. But they've been put in a different situation. And I think it's really important to give these people a voice and have them participate in to really call, you know, this technology a global village, to call the internet a global village. It really requires us being inclusive of everybody. And I think what you find is you often learn a lot of lessons for yourself from these people. I mean, people who live very simply, who live with frugality, who live with trying to, make the most of the resources that they have within nature. All of these things about, you know, environmentalism and trying to conserve. I mean, you go to a village and you'll see how conservation really works. And these people have real clear inventiveness, you know, very, very creative ways of expressing themselves. So I would just say that wisdom is in all corners and in all people. And I think it's our responsibility and for our benefit to listen to that.
Thank you. One of the co-hosts of the call doing stuff in the background is Amit, who sort of pioneered these forest calls. So it'd be great if Amit could do the closing bits here, Amit.
All right, thank you. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Neil, thank you. Thank you for sharing so much of yourself, whether it was indirectly via your letters of love or your story of serving others when you were down in Katrina, or whether it was the use of technology to aid farmers in rural India, introducing new technology to the sort of time-tested old technology of these farmers used to grow their crops. I can't begin to think of the number of things that, you know, I was able to sort of take away just from this sort of short call. Some of the highlights that sort of stand out was, you know, your keen ability to observe everything that you kind of go through. So whether it was, you know, when you decided to go to India with a one-way ticket and, you know, not having a preset agenda or plan, but just allowing for things to naturally emerge. And there's something important about that, just because when you allow something to naturally emerge, then you are really filling a true need that exists, rather than, you know, something that you may just sort of conjure up on your own and say, oh, maybe I think people need to do this, but this is an actual need that is filled. And so I think that there's something very beautiful about that. Really, you know, it seems that you really embody the term adding value, just because you do it in so many different dimensions of your life. And then another key takeaway was how you align your work with your values, so that it's no longer work. It's just living and being on vacation, I guess, in a sense. It forces me personally to look at not just my own work, but things that I choose to do in my daily life. I really love the wisdom of the farmer's question and how, you know, your response that everyone has wisdom, everyone has something to share. And it's important for us not just to listen, but to amplify and help people grow their seeds of wisdom. And so you already had a big fan club, you know, whether it started with your mom or Babu Mama. And I definitely think that it's expanded today. So thank you very much for that. I definitely had a bunch of takeaways myself, but perhaps that was what I needed to hear. And I'm sure that for others, there were other things that you had talked about, whether it was taking risks, having a strong work ethic, trying out, not being afraid to try different things out. And most importantly, taking time out to reflect, having introspection. And that was definitely apparent in the way that you were able to share everything. And so on that note, I was hoping that we could all just take another minute of silence, but in gratitude, not just for this call or for the wonderful job that Neil's mom did in raising such a lovely individual, but for all the love and the good things that we have in our lives, for, you know, the fan clubs that we have in our own lives. And so a moment of gratitude, please. And again, thank you, Neil, and thank you, Rahul, for moderating the call. Thank you. Nipun, if you don't mind. unmute everyone?
I had all these expectations and hopes. And I did all this.
Hello. All right, we have everyone unmuted, so just a heads up in case you have things going on in the background. We were hoping that just to kind of sign off on the call, we could do a collective big thank you from the Neil Patel fan club. And so on the count of three, Nipun, have you been able to unmute everyone?
I will as soon as maybe as soon as you finish.
Okay.
Otherwise, we won't be able to hear you.
Okay, great. Yeah. So on the count of three, a big thank you to Neil. One,
okay.
Two, and three.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. You rock star.
Thank you all, and thank you everyone else for being on the call. And we look forward to you guys participating. In future. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And now we can all be grateful for the mute feature, because otherwise we would. Thank you.
Bye bye. Bye.
Big hug.